This is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch international service. In today's series of highlights from the Radio Netherlands archives marking our 50th anniversary, we have two interviews. One with British-born writer Christopher Isherwood, and we begin with German actress, singer and writer Hildegard Knef. After the war, she was launched by Hollywood as the new Dietrich. However, 3 years later, in 1949, she returned to Europe without having a single Hollywood film to her name. After a number of successful movies in the old world, she became a Broadway star in 1955 in the Cole Porter musical Silk Stockings, based on the Garbo film Ninotchka. A large part of her autobiography, The Gift Horse, chronicles her growing up in Nazi Germany and the confusing post-war years. In 1972, Neville Gray spoke to her about this period in her life.
Der geschenkte Gal, The Gift Horse, a report on a life of actress Hildegard Knef, growing up in Nazi Germany, her American and movie years, and a return to Europe. Actress, movie star, singer, and now successful author, I asked Miss Knef why she's written the book, why this title, and why it's appeared just now.
I didn't want to write so much about myself. Of course, it's an autobiography, but I intended to use myself much more as a camera than somebody who is emotionally involved and talks about his own reactions. I just report, and I also call the book, aside from the title, The Gift Horse, Report on a Life. I wrote it at this specific time I started to write. I don't really know why I started at this specific time, except that I thought it was the right moment for me and also to report on a generation that was raised in Nazi Germany, with children hardly going to school when Hitler appeared, but nearly grown up when the war ended. And how is it for a generation to be held responsible for the crimes that the country committed, my country committed, at the same time knowing they're not really responsible because when they're 6 years old, they can't do anything against the dictatorship, of course. And how do you live with that form of collective guilt, which I, for my person, have accepted totally? And I thought it was a time now to write about it.
And the book chronicles most incredible experiences during the war, those rather awful Hollywood experiences, and also the mixed reaction you received in Germany on your return there. Just how did you manage to keep your sanity through all of those sort of things?
Well, maybe I haven't. I forgot about the title. You asked me about the title. The Gift Horse, I mean, you have the same saying in English, that you don't look the in the mouth. Now, there's also, which triggered it off for me to use that title, was that I, while I was writing the book, remembered a short story by J.D. Salinger called Teddy, with this boy, this 12-year-old boy, who's a so-called wonder child and extremely intelligent for his age, and being checked and heard by every professor in the world. And this boy foresees his own death. He's 12 years old and he knows that he will probably die the next day. And he says, I don't know what all the fuss is made about life and death. In my opinion, life is nothing but a gift horse. And it came back to me while I was writing. I thought it was the appropriate title.
Travel alone
Sometimes I'm east, sometimes I'm west. No chains can ever bind me. No remembered love can ever find me. I travel alone, fair though the places and faces I've known. When the dream has ended and passion has flown, I travel alone. Free from love's illusion, my heart is my own. I travel alone. Free from love's illusion, my heart is my own. I travel alone.
When you returned to Germany after the war, why so much work? Sometimes you were doing sort of two and more films at once. In fact, Carol Reed said that if they were good films, even had they been good films, it would still be too much. Were you trying to make up for lost time or something?
Yes, I suppose so. I was so overwhelmed by the fact that I was now allowed to work after 3 years of total isolation and not being allowed to work whatsoever in Hollywood. I was so overwhelmed by the fact that now I could, that I overdid it, of course, and it was a kind of frantic thing about it and was not triggered off by any almost artistic beliefs in any script. If a director like Carol Reed or Duvivier asked me to do a film, I practically jumped and took it and did much too much at that time. And which was very, very stupid, I must say, but it couldn't be helped. It was a reaction, probably quite a normal reaction for an actor who had been sitting around from 21 until 24, 3 years at this time of your life without work at all.
It must have been a rather strange experience as a German in the United States when you first went over there, being referred to sometimes as a term of endearment, but not always, being referred to as Kraut or the Kraut or our Kraut, and seeing some of those rather awful American and British films that rather distorted that every stage German was wie Herr Weiss of making you talk sort of thing. That must have been a rather strange experience to live under those conditions.
It was very frightening because on one hand, professionally, it was for me that first I wasn't, you know, that Selznick, who had brought me over to America, didn't dare to make a film with me because he suddenly realized it was too short after the end of the war to use a German in a major American production. So there I sat and didn't work. And it was a time where really Nazi was synonymous with German and vice versa. And then the McCarthy era started, and that was a very peculiar situation because I felt myself almost like a ping-pong ball in political commotions and activities and insanities. Because when McCarthy came and the McCarthy committee and this kind of witch hunt started, I was suddenly not this Nazi German, but I was suddenly that nice democratic German who had suffered so much on the hands of the Russians, and suddenly I was allowed to work. And I mean, while friends of mine like John Garfield were driven literally to suicide because they were not allowed to work anymore, because they had no money, because they had no friends anymore, because they refused to say anything in front of this un-American committee, I suddenly found myself with work. And that was quite insane. But aside from my own personal ping-pong ball situation, it to this day, it irritates me, to put it mildly, what those films have really done in the end. Those films that dealt with the Second World War, that dealt with Nazi Germany, because it, in fact, it belittled the horror of a dictatorship, of any dictatorship. It made it kind of funny, it made it kind of, you know, the jerks that always screamed Heil Hitler, but that behind it were those evil, demonic minds It left it completely out. It never showed that. It was that kind of hunky-dory Western where one comes from the left and the others come from the right and they meet in the middle, and the good people, the Americans, are always winning. And it showed the war and the dictatorship in its most idiotic way. And in the end, it even came to that. I think that through those films and through magazine articles and all that, it has come to the point where in the Western world, Hitler has almost become a standard whereby whatever happens in the world, somebody will say Hitler was worse.
Yes.
He became that kind of easy standard, and I think that's unforgivable, to put something that was as horrible and unbelievable as this Nazi regime, to put it up almost like a standard.
Today, Hildegard Knef no longer acts, but writes poems and songs which she sings in concert and on record. Most are of an extremely personal nature, and this is one of the most poignant of them.
Mein Freund, in der Zeitung stand's auf Seite 3. Mein Freund, du bist gestorben. Ich wollte dich sehen, wollte dich sprechen oder auch schreiben, schon gestern. Spätestens morgen. Hast du mich gebraucht? Brauchst du mich jetzt? Was habe ich versäumt? Was versäum ich jetzt? Wirst du beweint? Von wem, wenn nicht von mir? Es gab keine Tränen, keine Tränen zwischen dir und mir. Nein, es gab keine Tränen, mein Freund, bis jetzt. Nein, auch nicht jetzt.
Can you explain this strange love-hate relationship you've had with the German people during, before and after the war? On your return, for example, this incredible press vilification. You mentioned it in an interview with Catherine Stott of The Guardian last year.
Yes. Well, it is a very, very strange thing, and I suppose it happens to many people in show business anyway. There are times where they're accepted and times where they're shot at. Mm. And the stupid thing about it basically is, as long as you're in the film industry, you're being held responsible for something you're not really responsible for, and that is a film. The end product is a work of the author and the director, not the actor. But this is beside the point. You have to take in consideration that the German press suddenly found itself with something they haven't had for a long time during the Nazi regime. And now they had the power to speak freely. But they had the beginning of a democracy, and they went berserk with the freedom of printing and saying what they wanted. You have to learn very carefully that power also requires responsibility very strongly. And at that time, they went a little bit haywire in their reactions and a little over-emotional. And also came, of course, that I was the first German who had gone to America. And there was that kind of she left us feeling. And when I came back after I hadn't worked in America, that kind of what we call in German a horrible word, Schadenfreude, you know, to be happy about the trouble the other one had.
Yes, yes.
Such das Schöne, halt dich nicht auf bei denen, die verlernten zu sehen, was schön. Such das Schöne, halt dich nicht auf bei jenen, die niemals lernten zu sehen, was schön.
That interview was first broadcast in 1972. While Hildegard Knef was growing up in Berlin, Christopher Isherwood was also living in the German capital, witnessing the rise of Nazism. His impressions of those years are recorded in his Berlin Stories. They were later adapted into a stage play called I Am a Camera. That's a reference to the detached way in which he observed the world. It was a style he pioneered, and which, interestingly enough, Hildegard Knef used as well. The play was later turned into a musical, and finally into the movie Cabaret, starring Liza Minnelli. Isherwood's name will forever be linked to that of poets W.H. Auden and Stephen Spender, his contemporaries and his close friends. All three are sadly dead now, but they've left an indelible mark on 20th century literature. When Isherwood visited Holland in 1981, Ian Desteyns spoke to him.
W.H. Auden once described him as a cross between a cavalry major and a rather prim landlady. So when I went to meet Christopher Isherwood, it was with some apprehension, especially since I've had a sort of hero worship for the man ever since I first read the Berlin Stories. Born in 1904 in England, Christopher Isherwood has lived since the 30s in America, and today, in his mid-70s, he's a fit, neat man with the calm eyes of someone who's seen right through life. Isherwood came to Holland to promote his latest book, My Guru and His Disciple, an account of his meeting with and his relationship with a spiritual teacher, a Swami of the Vedanta religion. But I wanted to talk to him about writing in general and some of his other books. His books have an ease about them, simplicity, and I wondered if that meant that writing came easily to him.
Oh, not at all easy. And I polish everything, write draft after draft after draft. I can't say a straight sentence first time off, you know. I'm rather involuted, and it all comes out backwards. And that's all a matter of polish. The only thing is, I quite enjoy the polishing. I mean, I don't feel tortured, although sometimes I get so furious that I could smack my own face, you know. I mean, the clumsiness of the expression is not to be believed. But I just polish and polish and polish. I rewrite things dozens and dozens and dozens of times.
Do you have any particular routine? I mean, do you have to write each day or period in each day?
Well, I'm a great believer in the idea that it's sort of madness to imagine that you're going to do a full day's work every day. But what you should do is to make just a little motion of the will every day. Mm-hmm. The Swami used to say, used to shock people by saying, oh, just try to think of God occasionally. And in the same way, I remember an old man who ran a gym years and years ago that I used to go to, said, just promise me one thing, touch your toes every day for the rest of your life once. Of course I didn't. You know, it's too easy, you're told these things. You're told to go and bathe in the Jordan, you know, you say, are not Abana and Pharpar the rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? It's always like that, you know. You won't do these things.
How long does it take you then to write a book?
Oh, years, very often. Well, first of all, you see, the great thing is to find out how to do it. Problem I have, for instance, now, I've done something that was necessary, as far as I can see, but rather unwise. If you think of my whole life from the time I came to the States in 1939 through to the present day, I've torn a strip right down the middle, which is my relations with this particular man. and described that, used that strip in this book. Yeah. But now, all around this is what has become a fearful, unrelated conglomeration of objects and themes and people and so forth. And I cannot figure out what kind of a book would contain this sort of mass of showbiz and movie stars and journeys in various directions, additional memories of some of the people described in the book, such as particularly Hurd and Huxley, about whom I have a great deal more to say. And there seems to be no overview. It seems so formless. Whereas this book, of course, is has a form which is very easily comprehended. Two people meet and associate. And the association is, as they say, terminated by death. Not that it is, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, artistically speaking, yes. That's all that matters. I'm going to write the next book. And the first thing I'm going to do is, I have these monumental diaries, not always kept thoroughly, but big, big chunks, which are, and a great deal that can be reconstructed. And I just have to sit down when I get back home and spend weeks and weeks reading the whole thing through and annotating them and seeing what we can use and what we can't, what is amusing and what isn't. But even after they've been heavily cannibalized, there'll still be a great mass of stuff. If any unfortunate scholar after my death takes it into his head to edit them, it'll go through the most awful areas of boredom, toiling through all this stuff.
Do you think you would ever get to the stage where you'd say, that's it, I've got no more to write, I've written everything?
I don't know. I mean, for such a long time now, it's been clearly evident to me what I should do next. And I think it's entirely possible that this autobiographical series will run to not one but two more books, even. That's to say, there'll be Kathleen and Frank, Christopher and His Kind, My Guru and His Disciple, and then two more.
Mm-hmm. I think you once said that you agreed with the theory that a writer really only writes the same book over and over and over again until he gets it right. Do you think that's true?
Oh, yes, in a way, I think. And I mean, I never saw this intent in myself, but I see now that it does make a kind of mad sense, the idea that you start writing fiction related to your life, and then find that while the fiction is perfectly valid on its own level, it's still worthwhile to say what really happened, and then kind of philosophize over that. And then, of course, the question arises, what was it that made it necessary for me to have the fiction? And you can get a lot of mileage out of that, you know. Not just for the sake of writing books, but because it really is an interesting topic. Of course, I think that people are awfully disingenuous about this fiction thing. I mean, when you come down to it, we find that most of the greatest novelists were, in fact, being at least three-quarters autobiographical. Proust didn't come out of thin air. Tolstoy wrote about experiences that he'd really had. Hemingway went around saying, won't you never write about something one hadn't experienced? And, of course, it is perfectly true. There's another kind of artist, another kind of writer altogether, who expresses all this in what are apparently the most oblique fantasies and imaginations and fables and so on. But it seems to me that everything that one does must be autobiographical in a certain sense. Your fingerprints are always recognizable all over it in one way or another.
That leads me into thinking about The World in the Evening, which you've said is your worst novel. Why do you think that's so?
Oh, because I think that part of it is really very fakey. I mean, in other words, what happened there was quite a simple predicament that lots of writers fall into. I thought up this fairly ingenious construction for the book, with this sort of backhanded reminiscence through the letters and the dead woman and the novel and the whole thing told in a sort of peculiar, twisted way. And somehow I was so busy with all that construction that I left out the breath of life, the everything. I mean, this miserable narrator, he's what really gets me down. But then I don't like the woman either. I mean, the whole thing, it comes away in great pieces in your hands. I think really, you know, I got into it up to my neck and worked with it. And I had an enormous period that was really a state of writer's block, except that I was writing like mad, putting this contraption together, you know. And then the tail fell off, and then we got that on again, you know, and one engine started, the other one wouldn't, you know. I mean, talk about the spruce goose. This was, at least that flew across the harbor. But this thing was just absolutely wouldn't get airborne.
If that's the worst one, what would you say is your best book and why?
Well, I must say I've always felt, and quite a lot of critics now think so too, that A Single Man is the best one. But partly that is because it's a very, quite the reverse. It's sort of a real contraption. It works. It holds together, and it's a sort of entity. And anyway, that life day thing is a very good formula to use.
Your style is amazingly modern. I mean, when I look now back at, say, the Berlin things, it's very hard for me to think that they were written in, you know, 30s and 40s, because it seems as if they've been written today. Why is that, do you think?
Well, maybe it's a sort of a style which doesn't date very much, because it's very direct. Although it is full of tricks, actually.
Are you a writer with a message, do you think?
No, not in any real sense of a message. There is, of course, the sort of, in a way, the message of all this sort of, well, of art, perhaps, altogether. There's a certain message of reassurance, I think, in it all, that... I mean, I think art should, in a certain sense, give a kind of courage. But even that's sounds too melodramatic to say that.
Christopher Isherwood talking to Ian Desteins. The interview was first broadcast in 1981, and it's part of a series of highlights from the Radio Netherlands archives marking our Golden Jubilee. Next week, Dira Sushan talks to Dutch early music expert Ton Koopman.